And stay tuned now for the final part of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries. If you've been following this series over the past few months, you'll have heard all about the people and places who made up the history of the Vatican, from the earliest beginnings in the wake of St. Peter's martyrdom to key developments of the early 20th century. Now, Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett take a look back at the last half of the 20th century in this concluding episode entitled Watershed.
To the observer of the future, looking down the long telescope of time, probably no other century will seem so preoccupied with war and peace as our own. Long after the wailing of the sirens had died down and the hum of the munitions factories subsided, the noise and tumult of war continued to reverberate into the decades of peace.
The generations born in the immediate aftermath learned to live with the permanent threat of war. The ancient sword of Damocles had been replaced by the mushroom cloud of atomic explosion.
In the industrialized countries, daily life was undergoing a radical change. With more and more women out at work, the pattern of family life was altering.
By the late 50s, youth had become a mystique, the idols of the day often barely out of their teens. Film stars James Dean, Elvis Presley, and the sex symbols Marilyn Monroe and Brigitte Bardot reigned unchallenged on the screen.
The guitar emerged as an instrument of popular appeal. Groups proliferated, and as the boom in pop music continued unchecked, four young men calling themselves the Beatles became a byword around the world.
With the close of the decade, the uncertain, tepid post-war climate gave way at last to the robust optimism of the swinging 60s.
On the political scene, too, the mood was changing. In Washington, a man named John Kennedy became the youngest and first Roman Catholic president of the United States.
In Moscow, a peasant named Nikita Khrushchev began the demolition of the Stalin myth.
In 1962, the world came to the brink of nuclear war and held its breath while two men talked on a hotline. The crisis passed.
In Rome, a man named John was quietly disrupting the established order of the Vatican. To a world populated by prophets of doom had come a prophet of hope.
On a golden Roman afternoon in the year 1958, the crowd waiting anxiously in St. Peter's Square gave a sudden gasp as a wisp of white smoke curled up from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel into the October sky. Shortly afterwards, onto the central balcony of the Basilica came a small group of high-ranking prelates, and then the announcement.
Dominum, Angelum, Josephum, Sante Romane Ecclesie, Cardinale Meroncalli.
John the 23rd, as he chose to be called, was far from being the Pope of Transition people expected him to be. From the moment he set foot in the Vatican, things began to move.
The Johannine touch became immediately apparent. The new pope brought a new informality into the stuffy halls of the Vatican, dispensing with protocol or reducing it to a minimum. He had an intense dislike of unnecessary ceremonial, and to see men kneeling to him made him distinctly uncomfortable.
Innovator was hardly the word some thought would be linked with the caretaker pope, as they called him. But they proved wrong. The former Patriarch of Venice lost no time in getting to know his new diocese in person. Sunday visits to parishes and charitable institutions became a regular feature of this pontificate, together with a recitation of the Angelus from the window of the papal apartment which looked onto St. Peter's Square. It was Pope John who initiated this Sunday family gathering, and his warm, vital voice was soon familiar to Romans all over the city.
In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen.
For the present Holy Father, Pope John was the prophet whose voice shook the world. And in the words of Paul VI, his immediate successor, a friendly and happy point of light in the history of the Church and of the world.
A few months after his election, Pope John was talking about the state of the Church to his Secretary of State, Cardinal Tardini, when an idea came to him. He would call a council.
Councils are not called except in extraordinary circumstances. There have only been 20 councils since the Christian Church began. But the First Vatican Council had been interrupted and never resumed. There were matters still unresolved, and other new urgent matters which required serious consideration. More than all, the Church was in need of renewal, aggiornamento, bringing up to date.
Apart from Cardinal Tardini, Pope John asked no one else for an opinion. On January the 25th, 1959, he told the cardinals his decision after a mass at St. Paul's outside the walls. The effect was electric. It's been described as being like a fanfare of trumpets.
The papal march is heard, and high in the distance appears John the 23rd on the gestatorial chair, with the fan-bearers in front and behind sword and cape men in velvet and lace with red and blue sashes. The Holy Father passes slowly, blessing the crowd, who press forward to get a better look. The band on the steps plays as the Holy Father passes into the basilica, and now the organ thunders out across the morning, and band, bells and organ fill the air with sound.
Gaudet Mater Ecclesia, quod singulari divine providentiae munere, optatissimus iam dies illuxit, quum auspice Dei para Virgine, cuius materna dignitas odie festu ritu recolitur, hic ad beati pederi sepulcrum concilium ecumenicum.
This is where we end our journey back in time, at this shining point of light in the history of the Church. Although we know the story doesn't end here, the Vatican centuries will continue to roll on until, like ourselves, they are consumed by time.
And that brings us to the end of our weekly radio drama series, The Vatican Centuries.